1750 to 1800, Revolution and Rationalism, the third talk in a series on Christianity in America, was presented by Tim McIntosh on April 10, 2013, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
So now we're back on, which means I need to do a big review, and I'm going to do it fast because today is a big, eventful class. We are covering the American Revolution today. Big eventful class. So just to recap, this class is organized, is American Christianity or the History of the Church in America, and it's organized around a series of different challenges. So every week we talk about one or two challenges that the colonies or the nation will face. The first challenge that we talked about was, how do you create a Christian civilization? Because that's what the Puritans hoped to do when they came from England over to the American colonies. I began with the Puritans as opposed to, let's say, the Anglicans in Virginia, because I think that the Puritans left a mark on the United States that's even still with us. I'm not going to go into what those marks are, but we will revisit it frequently during class in subsequent weeks. The attempt to kind of start a Christian civilization in a way fails for the Puritans because they find that their kind of religious convictions and their passion for their religious conviction wanes and changes over the subsequent decades. And so eventually they have to go the way of Virginia and other states. They have to tolerate dissenting voices, dissenting religious ideas. That was the first week. The second week was two challenges. First, what's going to happen to Christianity absent the state's backing? So in England and in Europe, the state supports the church and is in many ways very intertwined with the church in formal ways. The colonists are resistant to that idea. And so how is Christianity going to thrive, or is it doomed absent state support? Well, it's not going to be doomed. The Great Awakening happens in the early part of the 1700s, and this religious widespread conversions take place up and down the eastern seaboard. And so Christianity, while not having the backing of the state formally, kind of goes in a much more popular direction. Pastors like George Whitefield, like John Wesley, are open-air preachers. They preach to thousands and thousands of people, and there's a widespread awakening of Christianity in the early part of the 1700s. So that challenge was, absent state backing, is Christianity just doomed? No, it's not, but it is going to change pretty dramatically. And a second challenge that we talked about during our last discussion was, how can we get along, people of radically different, what were then radically different, religious convictions, Anglicans, Congregationalists, Catholics, Puritans, Reformed, how are we going to get along? We see the development of what would be called denominationalism as opposed to sectarianism. There is a blurring of the harder lines of certain key doctrines in an effort to just basically live in peace with one's neighbor. And more religious conviction, we will see this in the United States, religious conviction becomes more and more of a private affair, less and less of a public affair. Or when it is a public affair, it becomes more soft, easier to abide. We'll talk about that in later classes also. Today, two big challenges. The time period that we will be talking about is a 50-year period from 1750 to 1800. The first big challenge is, will the colonists reject their spiritual mother? And by that I mean England. Are they going to reject their spiritual mother? The second big challenge, are Christianity and rationalism compatible? By rationalism, I'll just tell you now, we'll spend the second part of the class discussing it. I don't mean being a rational human being. I mean capital R rationalism, a movement, an almost religious movement that we'll sometimes refer to as the Enlightenment, in which the rational powers of the human mind and science are become a competitor eventually to Christianity. We'll spend the second half of class talking about that. So, here's the way I think that we should think about the 1700s. Think of the first 50 years of the 1700s in the colonies as being a spiritual revolution with the Great Awakening. Not only are there huge numbers of individual conversions, but the very shape of church itself is changing radically. From very hierarchical, where you've got a pope at the top or the Archbishop of Canterbury at the top in the Anglican Church, to being a much more flat, much more democratic organization. Okay? So not only are there lots and lots of people who are converting under the teaching of George Whitefield and John Wesley and Jonathan Edwards, but there's also a sense that the lay people can read their Bible, can serve their neighbors, can serve without having achieved high degrees as they would have to in Catholicism or Anglicanism. So the congregations of churches become much more active. Much more active. So 1700 to 1750, spiritual revolution. 1750 to 1800, political revolution. And the political revolution is independence from Great Britain. That's how we should think about the colonies in the 1700s. Okay, I'm already way off my notes here. Okay, I'm going to start with a story. This just typifies this kind of transition from the early part of the 1700s to the middle and late part of the 1700s. George Whitefield, this famous open-air British preacher, died in the colonies in September of 1740. He died in a place called Newburyport, New England. I believe it was Connecticut. He was scheduled to preach that day to a crowd of 18,000 people in New England. But he died and he was buried in Newburyport in 1740. Now fast forward almost exactly 25 years. September 16, 1775, church is being held at the church where he was buried. The bell of the old South Church was cast by a man who made his name just a few months earlier. His name was Paul Revere. He cast the bell of this church. This is about 5 months after the battles of Lexington and Concord, the beginning of the American Revolutionary War. The minister was a man named Dr. Jonathan Parsons, and he speaks about liberty. Liberty in 1775. He's so compelling, his preaching is so compelling, that a man named Ezra Hunt stepped into the church aisle and formed a company of 60 fighting men who would join the Patriot Army, volunteers to fight the British that day. And among them was Benedict Arnold before he turned. So this is like one of these moments, right? You see all these really important characters all kind of showing up at the same time. After the sermon, these 60 militiamen asked the church sexton if they could see where George Whitefield was buried. So they go out back into the cemetery. This is where George Whitefield had died earlier. Not only did the sexton show them Whitefield's grave, but he dug up the casket. And the soldiers took bits of material from like his priest's collar, the collar of his on his wrists. They took them and carried them with them into battle. Now, what George Whitefield would have said about this? George Whitefield would have been thoroughly against this. He spent so much of his time speaking in the relic worship of the Catholic Church to George Whitefield. So, anyway, it's like you can preach against religion, but you can't take that kind of like religious impulse for relic worship out of a person, I suppose. Okay. What's remarkable is during the time of the Great Awakening, an overwhelming majority of colonists would have said, England is my spiritual mother. We are at peace. Things are good with me and England. But by 1775, that had changed radically in a very short amount of time. So what exactly changed? We didn't just go from the Great Awakening to throwing tea in Boston Harbor. There, something happened. Something shifted pretty profoundly in the colonist mind. I'm going to talk about a few of those things. North America was, by the middle of the 1700s, of course, a British colony. But the strain was being between the British and the American colonists was being felt not just politically, but also religiously. So alongside of things like the Sugar Act of 1764 and the Stamp Act of 1765, the English were threatening, get this, to appoint Anglican bishops in the United States. England was going to appoint them. The Americans weren't going to appoint them. Just think how this is going to go over with the Americans. No, 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 no. Don't you remember why we left in the first place? So that we could appoint our own people. So that you in the government couldn't appoint our people. We get to appoint our people. So England is threatening to appoint Anglican bishops in the United States. This, of course, would have had huge political benefits to the Crown of England because they could have preached pro-Crown sermons. And the Americans are beginning to preach anti-Crown sermons. So crowd control. There's a vested interest in the part of the British Crown for crowd control in appointing these Anglican bishops. The Presbyterians and the Congregationalists get together and they write a letter. In it, the letter says, "The grand points of this union between Presbyterians and Congregationalists are the promoting of religion and the good of our denominations and to maintain a firm union against England's encroachments." Tensions continue to climb. And in the minds of many colonists, George III, who reigned in Great Britain from 1760 to 1820, was acting way too much like the Stuart kings of old, like James I and Charles I. He was domineering in the colonists' mind. And his domineering activity fostered a thirst for political and religious freedom. John Adams, in 1765, wrote a dissertation on the canon and feudal laws. Canon law, read ecclesiastical law, church law. In which he said, quote, "Under the exorable race of the Stuarts, the struggle between the people and the confederacy of temporal and spiritual tyranny became formidable, violent, and bloody. It was this struggle that populated America." This struggle made the people sail from England to the colonies. "It was not religion alone, as is commonly supposed, but it was a love of universal liberty and a hatred, a dread, a horror of the internal confederacy of church hierarchy and despotic rulers that projected, conducted, and accomplished the settlement of America. After their arrival here, they began their settlement and formed their plan both of ecclesiastical and civic government in direct opposition to the canon and feudal systems." Tensions continue to rise. Soon, preachers are issuing open warnings against England from the pulpit. 1750, Jonathan Mayhew, a well-known British minister, preached a sermon on the anniversary of the execution of Charles I, a Stuart. Charles I, remember, was executed in 1649 after a prolonged fight with Parliament. Charles believed that he was divinely ordained to be the King of England. Parliament disagreed with him. And the result was he lost his head. Cromwell's troops defeated him and decapitated him. Jonathan Mayhew in 1750 preached that all monarchs should rule for the good of their people or fear a fate similar to that of Charles I. Quote, "The hereditary, indefeasible divine right of kings and the doctrine of non-resistance to that right are altogether as fabulous and chimerical as transubstantiation."
Oh,
right. Not kidding around. 1774, England makes another mistake. The Quebec Act of 1774. This act gave Catholics in Quebec the right to, quote, "the free exercise of religion of the Church of Rome, subject to the king's supremacy, and authorized the church to collect its accustomed dues and rights," read, taxes. The British crown, in other words, is smiling upon the establishment of Roman authority and granting them permission to collect tax money. At this point, it's 1774, we're going to war. This is becoming absolutely intolerable. The colonists feared that England would introduce Catholicism into the colonies, which to some degree would have been acceptable to them, but their main objection to it was that it had the state's backing, right? Catholics in Maryland, there were plenty of Catholics in Maryland and other places, so it wasn't, I'm not going to say that Protestants smiled and welcomed Catholics as equal brothers. I don't think that they did, but there, I think, was a sense of toleration that the Catholics, it's okay, you've got a place here, but if England is going to say, hey, and we're going to help you, that's where the colonists said no. They draw the line there, no. Historian Carl Brandenburg wrote this, quote, "For us of the 20th century, it is very difficult to recover imaginatively a real understanding of the opinions and feelings of a pious dissenting people, the patriots, grown accustomed to ecclesiastical self-government and currently engaged in a struggle to protect their liberties in the civil sphere. England's threats, which they read in every week's newspaper, produced a cumulative effect like the rising crescendo of a bolero. The agitation over an American episcopate reached its peak by 1770, and the public had grown almost frenzied in the course of it." There's a hymn that was written by a man named Joseph Thomas that illustrates the sentiment. I'm going to read you the hymn. "A horrid thing pervades the land, the priests and prophets in a band called by the name of preachers direct the superstitious mind. What man shall do his God to find, he must obey his teachers. Let Christians now unite and say, we'll throw all human rules away and take God's word to rule us. King Jesus shall our leader be, and in his names we will agree. The priests no more shall fool us." Things snapped into open warfare in 1775. John Peter Gabriel Muhlenberg was an Anglican minister in Woodstock, Virginia, when war broke out. At the close of Sunday sermon, shortly after the Battle of Bunker Hill, which was June of 1775, Muhlenberg read from the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 3. "To everything there is a season under heaven, a time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant and a time to reap, a time to heal and a time to break down, a time of war and a time of peace." Muhlenberg then said, "The Bible tells us, quote, there is a time for all things, quote, and there is a time to preach and a time to pray. But the time for me to preach has passed away, and there is a time to fight, and that time has now come." He then steps out of the pulpit into the vestry room, changes into the uniform of an American officer, and proceeds to enlist most of his male congregation in the militia. Muhlenberg became a general and ended up playing a pretty crucial role in some very important battles, and there's a statue of Muhlenberg in the U.S. Capitol building. Another example of a patriot minister, a Presbyterian chaplain, James Caldwell, was with American troops near his home in Springfield, New Jersey, when a skirmish broke out. The troops ran out of paper to ram powder and balls into their muskets, so Caldwell dashes into his church, gathers up hymnals of Isaac Watts, and charges out to the soldiers with the cry, "Now put Watts in 'em, boys." Two groups of Christians did not support the revolution. As you would expect, the loyalists did not support the revolution. Roughly one-fifth to one-third of the colonists considered themselves loyalists. Some Congregationalists and Presbyterians and Catholics also considered themselves loyalists, or at least did not support the revolution. Pastors in these churches rebuked revolutionary pastors for shaping scripture to suit their political leanings, and they had a pretty good case to make. Jonathan Boucher, B-O-U-C-H-E-R, an Anglican from Maryland, preached a 1775 sermon entitled "On Liberty, on Civil Liberty, Passive Obedience, and Non-Resistance." His text was Galatians 5:1. "It was for freedom that Christ set us free." And he argued, believe this, that the text was not about politics, that Christ died to set us free not from abusive monarchs, but from the rule of sin. "Obedience to government," said Boucher, "is every man's duty," citing Romans 13. He didn't get much of an audience. The other major group that did not support the war were pacifists, or peace churches, like Quakers, Mennonites, Moravians, Church of the Brethren. The Quakers in North Carolina, as an example, treated casualties on both sides after the Guilford courtroom battle of May 1781. They used the opportunity to protest all warfare. They provided provisions for whichever army occupied their city. And when the other side took over, they were punished providing the previous enemy. The revolution, the American Revolution, I'm not talking just about the war, but the change from 1750 to 1800 occurs in about four stages. First, the deteriorating relations with England and growing sentiment for independence, 1760, 1775. It's the first stage. Second stage, war and reorganization, 1775 to 1783, in which the colonists fought the British, established a constitution, and organized from townships into states. So, first, changing sentiments and deteriorating relations to England, then war and reorganization. Third, the critical period in which the now United States faced the problem of federalism, and they debated, they had this whole debate over states' rights versus federalism. That lasts roughly 6 years, 1783 to 1789. Fourth period, fourth and last part of the revolution, the Federalist period, a period of crucial self-determination during which the problems of federal union under the Constitution and foreign relations of the new nation were settled. This lasted from 1789 to 1800. 18 years after this final period came to a close, John Adams wrote a letter to a friend reflecting back on this period, the period from 1750 to 1800. In the letter he says, quote, "What do we mean by the American Revolution? Do we mean the American War? The revolution was effected before the war commenced. The revolution was in the minds and hearts of the people, a change in their religious sentiments of the duties and obligations. The people of America had been educated in a habitual affection for England as their mother country, and While they thought of her as a kind and tender parent, no affection could be more sincere. But when they found her a cruel mother, willing like Lady Macbeth to dash their brains out, it is no wonder that their affections ceased and were changed into indignation and horror. This radical change in the principles, opinions, sentiments, and affections of the people was the real American Revolution. So you can kind of see it, can't you? They went from such affection, such loyalty to England in 1750 to such violent dislike in such a short amount of time. And Adam's letter kind of helps explain it. There was such a strong affection that when they felt that England was betraying them, then the heat was twice as hot as the love was. If that makes sense. In the two decades after the war, churches reached a low ebb of vitality, the lowest, it seems, at any point in American history. Why? The obvious reason is war is extremely disruptive. Churches lose pastors, elders, young men, and other leaders. And during this time, after the war, churchgoers are much more preoccupied with military and political questions than they are with ecclesiastical questions. However, there is one religious movement that seems to be growing in popularity at this time, and that was the cult of reason, or what I will call rationalism, or what I'll also call the Enlightenment. What is the cult of reason? What is the Enlightenment? What is rationalism? If you remember back to week one, I said, think about if you were neither a Protestant living in... Think about if you're a Western European and you are neither a Protestant nor a Catholic, what might you be? And I gave you three potential options. The first were the spiritualists. I mentioned a guy named Emanuel Swedenborg. There's this huge Swedenborgian church in Washington, D.C. that my brother and sister-in-law and I passed. I mentioned that. He had had a series of visions. George Fox, the Quakers. These spiritualists had a sense that there's an inner light. There's some divine light in all of us, the spark of God in all of us. And if we follow that and clear away the clutter, then we can be reborn in some way. So those are the spiritualists. That's one of the options I talked about. The other were the pietists, so the Moravians, who really influenced John Wesley. Their response to the fight between the Protestants and the Catholics is live a quiet, practical, pious life. Serve your neighbor. Study the Bible. Pray. Just live a quiet life. So the pietist, that's the second option. And this is the third option, the rationalists. They kind of get their start with a man named Rene Descartes, who is a philosopher and a scientist. And then in the 1700s, they are given even more, the great names of the Enlightenment, like John Locke and like David Hume, are writing and publishing in England, and they are proposing a change to the way that people view the world. And this, I'm going to talk plenty about this. This change, this different way of viewing the world, I'm calling rationalism or the Enlightenment. What exactly do I mean by that? I mean this. So Locke and Hume are, I'm just going to stick with Hume for the time being. Hume is, in essence, he is just an atheist that looks at religion as a good way to keep men in the dark. But if we just exercise our reason, we can arrive at the truth. We can figure this stuff out. Science, look at what science is doing for us. Look at all the advancements that science is making. These scientists are racing ahead because they have kind of thrown off the false mantle of religion, and they're just daring to think for themselves for a change. Okay? This is the general trend of the Enlightenment. And it begins to become very popular in the United States during the time, during and after the Revolution. And so this challenge is facing the United States, at least among thinking people who are aware of this current of rationalism. Are Christianity and rationalism compatible? Are they compatible? Before we jump too deep into it, I want to just say that this is an ongoing question for Christians ever throughout the Western world. It has been an ongoing question about how much Christianity is something that is available to natural reason, something that can just be inspected by using our minds. Can it just be inspected using our natural reason? Or can we only understand the truths of Christianity if it is revealed to us? If it's revealed to us. This back and forth has been a tension probably since Jesus Christ ascended into heaven. And the Bible seems to give evidence for both sides. So, Romans 1:20, since the creation of the world, God's invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead. On the other hand, the scriptures seem to indicate that knowledge of God is something revealed to the individual and not the result of just a long chain of reasoning. After Peter confesses Jesus as the Messiah, Jesus says, "Blessed are you, Simon Peter, for flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father in heaven." So, also, we see in the life of Paul that he seems to hold that Christianity is both publicly available, but also something that must be revealed from heaven. So he publicly reasons with the Jews and Gentiles in the synagogue or in Athens. He publicly reasons with them. Yet he also admits the world, through wisdom, did not know God. So it pleased God through the foolishness of the message preached to save who believe. The general trend is that when Christianity is popular, when it is commonly accepted in a populace, as in medieval Europe, it tends to be viewed as something openly accessible by reason without need for special revelation. When Christianity is in the minority, it tends to be viewed as something hidden, something which God reveals. That's just kind of like the general sociological trend. Christianity was, of course, in the United States at this time, overwhelmingly popular. Thus, to the well-educated, Christianity was viewed as being accessible by natural reason, especially the morality of Christianity. They viewed with increasing suspicion the miraculous events of Christianity. Okay? So this kind of rationalistic impulse loves the morality of Christianity. Love your neighbor. But Jesus' resurrection, science doesn't really see many resurrections. Not really sure that we're going to buy that. Okay? So there's this funny thing happening at this time. Christian morality is upheld, esteemed as a good thing, but some of the central tenets of Christianity, namely Christ's resurrection, are viewed with increasing suspicion. These are the two things that are happening at the same time. Okay. Sidney Alstrom is an American church historian. I think he's great. He's wonderful. And here's a quote from his two-volume set on Christianity in the United States. As the Enlightenment progressed, more and more thinkers came to accept its primary assertion that reason and scientific knowledge could supply all of the necessary elements of religion and ethics, though many might concede that revelation was still needed by the masses. The growing enthusiasm for Newtonian cosmology and Lockean philosophy had broad effects, and natural religion flourished in alliance with revealed religion in the theology of many Christian rationalists. John Locke is an example of one. John Locke, who Thomas Jefferson believes is one of the three greatest men who ever lived, he also, I think, believe that Jesus Christ is one of the greatest men who ever lived. I don't know who he thought the third one was, but John, or who the second one was. John Locke was the third one. And permeating Locke's thought, says Ahlstrom, was an abiding confidence in natural law, which, though eternal and transcendent, was yet accessible to human reason whenever the mind was free from bondage, superstition, and the passions. Such law controlled the relations of mankind as well as the natural order of things. This kind of reminds me of Stoicism a little bit, doesn't it, Jack? Which brings us to a big debate. Were the founding fathers Christians? Were they not Christians? So I'm going to answer the question for you. Actually, I'm going to give you my opinion. This has been a long, I mean, if you've paid any attention to kind of debates about the United States and the history of the United States, this is it's probably still kind of a big question in some people's minds. I'll tell you a little story. I did an internship in Washington, D.C. my junior year in college, and I was raised in a Christian home, and I had long been familiar with the idea that many of the founding fathers were Christians, either because they were pastors or at least lay leaders in their churches. But I had no idea until I remember this one day I was walking through the Capitol building, U.S. Capitol building, and there's a little room. It's not much bigger than this. This is my memory we're using. So I remember it not being much larger than this. And it's just populated by all these beautiful marble statues. Beautiful marble statues of founding fathers. Not just the big heavies, Jefferson, Washington, but some of the lesser lights, or who would be to us lesser lights. Like John Witherspoon, Charles Carroll, Roger Sherman, John Jay. So I remember walking through, and there are little placards at the bottom of each statue. I'm telling you, every one of them had a Christian affiliation of one sort or another. I'm not exaggerating. Every single one. John Witherspoon was eventually the president of Princeton, a Presbyterian minister. John Carroll, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, a Catholic layman. Roger Sherman, signer of the Declaration, influential in the Constitutional Convention, was a member of Jonathan Edward Jr.'s church. John Jay, the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Patrick Henry of Give Me Liberty, Give Me Death fame. Both were low church Anglicans. So I was kind of stunned. I was kind of open to the idea that, yeah, there's like a really strong Christian influence in America's founding. But I still saw the Hall of Statues, and I was kind of really shocked by it. Furthermore, I don't know if you guys have ever seen this, but there's a series of relief sculptures in the U.S. House of Representatives. They are of great lawmakers from antiquity to the modern day. And the way that they are organized is this. There are two doors that open up to the gallery in the House of Representatives. Now, I don't know if this is the old or the new House of Representatives. I think it's the old. Over the two doors, there are a series of relief sculptures of great lawmakers. Think Hammurabi, Solon, and they are looking toward each other so you can see their profiles. But they're all looking toward a central figure who is not in profile, but is looking head on at you. Do you any guess who that might be? Good guess. Not Jesus, though. Who's the
Moses.
Moses is looking direct, and all of the other lawmakers are looking at Moses, right? He's the pinnacle. So, this question about the founding fathers and about is the United States, was it a Christian nation or something like that? We're going to wade into this right now. It's a very loaded conversation for a variety of reasons. I think a lot of non-Christians or even Christians who are skeptical of the idea that the United States was a Christian nation are skeptical for maybe reasons like this. Oh, you Christians who argue that we're a Christian nation want us to go back to a time that has long since passed us by, and you want us to live by something like Old Testament law, or you want to set up a theocracy, and we have no interest in that. So they don't like, I think that there's kind of a sense that they don't want the beginnings of America to be so imbued with Christianity, because if that point is given, doesn't it necessarily follow that we're supposed to be a theocracy today? Now, I don't know. Let me check that. I do know some people who think that there should be a theocracy. I think the number of Christians that I have met in my life who think that are less than 0.1%. But that 0.1% can be very vocal, extremely intelligent, and can make and are not afraid to rely on biblical arguments to make their case. However, I think the vast majority of Christians recognize that Jesus did not come to set up a nation state. That was not his intent, that it should not be our intent. Now, on the other hand, some Christians will want to argue, yes, we were a Christian nation. And I think a lot of Christians who want to make that argument just look at something like I looked at, the Hall of Statues, and you see all of the tremendous influence that Christianity had on the founding fathers and also on the populace at large. And so they say, thus, we are a Christian nation. So I don't think that we were ever a Christian nation, despite the fact that we were overwhelmingly more influenced by Christianity than any other religious system. And I mean specifically Protestant Christianity was number one with the bullet, the most influential religious system in the United States during the formative years of the American colonies. I just think to argue otherwise is, I just don't think that you can make the case. I know of no secular or religious scholar who knows their history, who would deny Protestant Christianity's tremendous influence in the colonies and in the early part of the United States. I don't think that we were a Christian nation on theological grounds. I don't think there's such a thing as a Christian nation. I just don't think that Jesus came to start a nation state. He is much more concerned with changing the hearts of men, and organically that can grow into churches, of course. But to try to orchestrate Jesus' teaching from the top down just seems fundamentally at odds with the whole Christian message. So for that reason, I think, yeah, tremendously influential, tremendously influenced by Christianity. I just can't make the argument, and I don't believe on theological grounds that we were or could be a Christian nation. Now, the question of the founding fathers, were they Christians or were they deists? On that, it's a mixed bag. So, it seems like some of the founding fathers were Christians, but some of the most influential founding fathers, I'm thinking Jefferson, I'm thinking Franklin, I am thinking Hamilton, they were much more, it seems, deists than Christians. So very friendly with Christianity, not at odds with Christianity, but I had a much more deistic view, and by deism, think this, rather than God being involved in the everyday affairs of man, God created the world like he created a clock. He then wound that clock according to natural laws, and then he put the clock on the shelf to basically run its course. That's what when I think of deism, that's the way I think of deism. So Franklin and Jefferson, they would find that a much more compelling vision than traditional Christianity. Okay, I'm so far off my notes now. However, the founding fathers were not hostile, for the most part, during these formative years. They were not hostile to Protestant Christianity, and I'll give you an example. Franklin and Thomas Jefferson were appointed to draw up a seal for the United States of America. Here's Franklin's first idea. Do you guys know this? Franklin's first idea for the seal of the United States is Moses with Pharaoh in the background with a subtext reading, "Rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God." That's Franklin's first idea. Jefferson's first idea. The seal would show the children of Israel in the wilderness being led by a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. Eventually, both those ideas were dropped, and the official seal today, which I think it's the eagle holding the, what is it, holding arrows in one hand. I don't have a dollar bill on me, otherwise I would look at it. That's what becomes the official seal. But you can see, even there, Franklin and Jefferson are using Old Testament symbols, biblical symbols, that would register with the people of the United States. Okay, I'm going to try to get back to my notes. Franklin, late in his life when he's age 81, during a particularly contentious period of the Constitutional Convention in 1787, requested that the convention begin each day's session with prayers, saying, quote, "The longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men, and without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel." Franklin's motion failed, ostensibly because the convention had no funds to pay for a local clergyman to act as a chaplain. So, for now, Christianity and rationalism, are they compatible? For now, the answer is yes. Though this is a peace, this is a marriage that will not last very long. Ethan Allen, who is a war hero who helped found Vermont, in 1784, publishes an open attack upon the Bible and upon priestcraft. And Thomas Jefferson, late in his career, after being bullied by Federalist preachers, will become bluntly anti-clerical. And so you can see by the late part of the 1700s and early part of the 1800s, this marriage between rationalism and Christianity is beginning to unravel a little bit. And it will continue to unravel during the 1800s, and it will officially unravel in the early part of the 20th century. But for now, the challenge, rationalism and Christianity, can they get along? Are they compatible? Most people, most educated people are going to say, yes, they are. So think of this marriage this way. Think of the Enlightenment as one spouse in the marriage kind of saying, honey, I promise that I won't talk about David Hume, who is a strict atheist and thinks that the world is all that matters with no God in it. And I won't talk much about what happened in France either, because France is setting up temples of reason. I'm not going to go that far. We're not going to eat crepes in the household. We'll eat hot dogs. I'll meet you halfway. So I won't talk about the hard things, the hard direction that rationalism is going toward atheism, so long as you don't talk about things like Jesus feeding the 5,000. It's as long as you don't talk too much about Jesus' resurrection, because these are miraculous things that I'm finding it increasingly hard to believe in, okay? So that's the marriage. That's what they're doing. That's the kind of meeting in the middle. They're each giving up the hard parts of their doctrine in an attempt to meet in the middle. It will not last forever. Oh, man. Oh, man. Okay. What do we make of this marriage? Now, man, this is going to be hard to do. Okay. The name of Thomas Jefferson's party that he formed when running for president or shortly before that was the Democratic Republican Party. I'm going to talk about republicanism for a second, because I think in republicanism, you're going to see kind of you're going to see how Christianity and rationalism both kind of get mishmashed together. Okay. So what do I mean by, historian Robert Kelly and others have argued that republicanism was the distinctive political consciousness of the entire revolutionary generation. Another historian, Thomas Kidd, writes, "A new blend of Christian and Republican ideology led religious traditionalists to embrace wholesale the concept of Republican virtue. Jefferson named his party the Democratic Republican Party, after this kind of temperament of the time, the Republican temperament. And 100 years later, the Republican Party, started by Abraham Lincoln and friends, adopt republicanism as the name of their political party, hearkening back to this original idea back at the founding of the United States. What is it? What am I talking about? I'm obviously not talking about the tenets of the contemporary Republican Party, Newt Gingrich, Rush Limbaugh. So I am talking about the term republic, which is adopted by many of the founding fathers to describe the sort of political system or the political ethos that they are after. In its basic form, the word republic means that form of political government without a hereditary ruling class. But of course it means much more than that. It's not just government without hereditary ruling class. Republicans, or the Republican sentiment, looked back on political constructions of previous times, like the Romans, and they gathered kind of the best of, and they adopted them as their own. I had a whole section I'm not going to go into right now about how the founding fathers looked at the development of the Roman Constitution, and from the Roman Constitution developed this idea of balanced but separate powers, legislative, executive, legal, whatever that is. So I'm not going to spend time on that. The thing that I'm going to emphasize is the strong Republican belief that citizens of the United States had unalterable, unreversible, unalienable rights. The Declaration states it overtly. All men are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. These rights cannot be voted away by a majority of voters. These rights include, according to the Constitution's first 10 amendments, called the Bill of Rights, the right to freely speak, peaceably assemble, bear arms, practice the religion of their choosing, and receive a fair public trial. It is hard for me to imagine that these inalienable rights would be birthed in a culture not steeped in Christianity. It's very difficult for me to imagine that. I think that because our political conversation is so full of that phrase, inalienable rights, that we take it for granted that people just say, yeah, all people are born with inalienable rights. This is not the case. I remember my mom telling me about an Indian woman that she met who was lower caste Indian. There's a missionary in her town, and she starts going to a Bible study. And she starts studying the Bible, and she has a revelation after studying the Bible for a couple of years. The revelation, I am a person. I am a person. This is not the natural equipment that you come with. You know what I'm saying? This is not the natural course of events. But I think we're so used to this because we read in our scripture that God knows the number of hairs on our head, that He knows us before we were born. We're so used to that that it doesn't strike us as utterly crazy, this idea that we just have natural rights given to us by our Creator. And I think this is the way that I think about this little period, this fusion of rationalism and Christianity. I think that rationalism made public the thing that Christians understood internally, that God cares who we are, knows who we are, values us as individuals. I think the rationalist impulse in writing the Constitution, in writing the Declaration, made that internal recognition a public thing. Does that make sense? And I think that is an unbelievable step forward in governance. And oppressed minorities forever since then have pointed back on that and said, that is what we want. That is a good thing. So I'm going to later be critical of this amalgam that forms of Christianity and rationalism. But this, I think, is an unabashedly good thing, that rationalism makes public what had been kind of this private, I'm getting a little bit sloppy with my language, but I think you understand me. This thing that had been subject of an internal conviction among Christians that I have value before God regardless of my place in society, regardless of my gender, regardless of what country I was born in, regardless of what family I was born to, I have value to God. I think that the rationalist impulse makes that public and puts it into the Constitution and the governing documents of the United States. And I think that's a good thing. Yes.
What extent do you think this is Christianity itself, or is it, and by that I mean New Testament Christianity, and a marriage between rationalism and Christianity? For instance, you referenced that there was this concept that it was kind of a Christian duty to rebel against tyrants, and that might even involve violence. Mm-hmm. But you're certainly going to go to some passages like Romans 13, where the bread and butter of that passage is do not resist. Mm-hmm. Whatever the government does to you, do not resist.
Yeah.
Of course, there's other interesting narratives like Exodus, but you're going to find other morals like don't resist at all. So rationalism may be beginning with Christian ideas like love your neighbor and stuff, but developing that so that it applies to minorities and things. And this didn't even abominate slavery yet, right? So this...
Right. Yeah, that's next on my list to talk about.
Okay. I guess we talk about Christianity being the cause of this, and I definitely see how Christianity is a major contributor. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't seem to me like it's just New Testament Christianity. It seems to me like it's a marriage between New Testament Christianity and rationalism, which would inherently disagree with some passages in the New Testament.
So it sounds like we're saying the exact same thing.
Are we? Okay.
Yeah. So what I'm arguing is not that Christianity exclusively on the world scene recognizes the individual value of persons. I don't think that. I mean, I think Socrates recognized the individual value of persons.
Okay.
But I think that impulse in Christianity is all over the Bible. It's just a fact. It's all over the place. I think that Christians who know their Bible moderately well recognize the individual value that God holds each individual as valuable. And I think what happened in this time in the United States is that the rationalists, like founding fathers, take that conviction, that Christian conviction that all people are valuable in and of themselves, regardless of their birth, regardless of their background, mm-hmm. and it makes it a publicly recognized right. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Two looming problems, and we're going to close with this. 60 seconds left. I cut just enough to get by. One political problem, one religious problem. Not that the two are really easy to separate at this point. They are definitely not. For all of this clamoring for inalienable rights and freedom from the British, slavery is an everyday fact in the United States. It seems stunning to us that the colonists can have so much moral indignation against the British while at the same time owning slaves. It's like, how in the world did you not recognize that you have a serious problem here? There's some serious hypocrisy going on. And some of the founding fathers that are involved in the writing of the Constitution, they know it. They say so. John Jay expresses deep regret over the passage in the Constitution that spoke of other persons, read slaves, as counting as 3/5 for congressional representation. And later, John Jay leans toward abolition, the abolitionist movement. I know that John Adams was also expressed just kind of a sense of bewilderment that they could hold both of them, they could both own slaves and at the same time be so vitriolic in their opposition to the encroachments of the British crown. So that's the first problem. The second problem is that the marriage between republicanism, that the marriage between Christianity and rationalism cannot remain intact forever, as I have alluded to. I'm going to read you the last paragraph of the Thomas Jefferson Bible. Do you guys know about the Thomas Jefferson Bible? So he made his own Bible. I've actually held a copy of one of them in my hands. A friend of mine bought one at a pawn shop somewhere. This is hopefully going to illustrate the fact that the rationalists and the Christians cannot remain together forever. Here it is, last paragraph of Thomas Jefferson's Bible. Then they took the body of Jesus and wound it in linen clothes with the spices, as the manner of the Jews is to bury. So Jefferson takes a Bible, just to those of you who are not aware of this, he takes a Bible and he basically cuts the parts out of it that he's not too wild about. Then he puts it back together again. Okay, so that's what he's doing. They took the body of Jesus, wound it in linen cloths with spices, as the manner of the Jews is to bury. Now, in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden a new sepulchre, wherein never a man yet laid. There they laid Jesus, and rolled a great stone over the door of the sepulchre, and departed. That might be a little bit chilling for you. I remember I read the end of it, and I thought, What? I don't understand. How can you just cut the resurrection and everything else out? But Thomas Jefferson did it. Just a little side story. I remember I was studying for one of my seminary classes, and I can't remember how I got in a conversation. I was eating at Chick-fil-A, this restaurant in the South, and this very kind woman was running the register, and she was talking about Thomas Jefferson's Bible. I can't remember how we got on this subject. And I said, yeah, well, Jefferson cut all the miracles out. He cut the resurrection out, for goodness sakes. And she was very well-meaning. She was a Christian, and she really liked this pastor in Florida. I can't remember his name. It's probably better that I can't remember his name, who really wanted Christian America to kind of rise up again. And she said, well, pastor in Florida says it's because Jefferson wanted to teach ethics to the Indians. That's why he cut the miracles out of the New Testament. And I thought, okay, number one, that's just not true. Number two, even if it was true, what happens to Christian ethics when you cut all the miraculous, or in specifically the resurrection of Jesus, out? Do you really have any sort of like coherent ethical system? You don't. You just don't. So, that to me kind of typifies the situation that the colonists find themselves in. The ending of Jefferson's Bible. The morality of Christianity is wonderful, something to be upheld, but the miraculous aspects of Christianity, that cannot abide with this kind of rationalist sentiment that's becoming more and more popular. The end. Any questions or comments? Sorry, I went a little over. Thanks very much, you guys. Okay. So I'm planning on giving, I've given three talks and I'm planning on giving seven more.